But nobody wants, obviously nobody wants to hear, you know, unsolicited advice like that. But when I do hear that, I just think, you know, I think, I guess it's measured though, because as I can look at a comment like that and say, you know, well, that's cute. There's, you know, 1,000 other people that could look at me and could say, bro, you don't know what adversity is. Like, you had a liver transplant, you had the best medical care, you know, maybe in the world at a UCSF hospital. Like, that's not adversity. You know what adversity is? Adversity is having no health insurance. Adversity is, you know, having sickness and not having any family support, not having any friends that care about you, right? So,
keistering a weapon in prison.
There it is.
Greetings. Welcome to the Between Two Wheels podcast. This is Tyler Yonke, your host. I did promise you last time we were going to have Kurt Mills with us. He's AWOL. We're sending our prayers out. We have no idea where he's at.
No idea.
No idea. So I'm joined today with Nate Dunn and Travis Retzler. Is that, did I say that right?
Retzler.
It's a silent L. Okay. Well, thank you guys for both showing up here. We just finished a nice long ride, the Coffee Republic ride. You guys can check it out on Strava if you want to. Who won Ridge Road? That's always the important thing.
Well,
Nielsen Palace won.
Yeah, well, he's won from a long time.
On today's ride.
On today's ride, yeah.
I guess it was pretty close at the end. You know, I mean, he probably came around me right before the Strava Live was like, but
Travis won.
So the big question from there is, what is your ride title? Because I know Nate loves to ride title
there troll. There will be no ride title for me. It's I have
afternoon ride.
Yeah, just whatever Strava does, that works for me.
All right. So for me today, my day's been pretty good. Other than I just dumped a protein shake down my back. That's a different story. And we're gonna have to go into that. So the big idea today is to introduce, talk to Nate Dunn of Data Driven Athlete. He's a coach, and want to give us a little background first about how you got into cycling and kind of what you're doing now with cycling before we go into their big issue, which is your, I don't even know how to put it. You're not just double world transplant games, world champion, but there's two events.
That sounds a little bit too celebratory, But yeah, I got into cycling. I played lots of different sports through elementary school, high school. And after graduating from college, wasn't playing as much basketball, some of those other sports that I was always active in. And I started putting on a little bit of weight. You know, I wasn't getting too big, but enough to where I needed to start being active again. And one of my friends had been trying to get me into cycling for a while, and that was never really of interest to me. My only memory of cycling had been riding an old mountain bike. And I had never ridden a road bike before, so that was a totally new experience for me to ride a bike that was so efficient. And that so went on my first ride. I had so much fun that I bought a used bike, I think probably the next day. The next day I went on a 50-mile ride.
So was that first ride a mountain bike or a road bike?
No, the first bike was an old Univega that my friend had.
All right.
And even though it was an old bike, I had just never experienced that type of efficiency before. I think if you come from a background where you've only maybe ridden kind of a crappy bike or an old mountain bike with knobby tires, you just don't know what a bike can actually feel like. And I enjoyed it so much. And so I purchased a used bike, and then I just started riding a ton. Not riding a ton. I started riding more regularly. And then when I really started taking more interest in it, I was actually coming down on the same road that we came down today on Auburn Folsom one time. I'd been riding for probably a couple months. And there was a guy that came behind our little group on Auburn Folsom, and he kind of attacked through. And I didn't really know what he was doing, but I knew that he was trying to beat us. And just that level of competitiveness and the idea that in the sport of cycling, you can engage in that, and that's really what racing is. It's kind of that tactical nature of attacking was so exciting. I went home that night. I didn't know anybody that raced. I didn't know any teams, but I just went online and I said, I'm going to buy my race license and I'm going to see when the next race was. So I found a race in Menlo Park. It was the Menlo Park Grand Prix. I told my wife, I said, hey, we're going to go next week and we're going to rent a hotel and we're going to go do my first bike race.
Big time. Renting a hotel.
I know. Exactly. So I went over there. I bought a book on how to race. I read the book before the race. I was like, I didn't know how to pin a number.
Was this like Racing for Dummies or what's the, do you recall the book?
Yeah, no, I think it was Bike Racing 101 or something like that. And it just kind of, you know, I was, for me, whenever I've been interested in something, I try and learn as much as I can about it. So before the bike race, I was reading about, you know, how to pin on a number. And I did that bike race, my first bike race. I got sixth in that race, but regardless of what the result was, it was just so, it was so intense and exciting. That moment really changed my life, because riding a bike was fun. It was more of a form of exercise for me, but it was racing that, it was racing that was just totally different than anything I experienced.
So I know you went to school and you grew up more in the Napa area.
Yeah.
And now you live in the Sacramento area. Where were you living at the time when you said you came down Auburn Folsom in Sacramento? Were you living in Napa still or St. Helena? Yeah. Or were you living here?
Yeah, so we had just moved to Sacramento. My wife and I got married. I grew up in the Napa Valley. We moved to Loma Linda for a year. That's where I first started riding. I had been riding a bike for, like I said, maybe just a couple weeks. And then I purchased a bike used. And then we had been living here in the Sacramento area probably just for a couple months at that point.
So in Loma Linda, which is down in Redlands, did you ever experience the Redlands Classic? Did you ever go take that in?
No, I didn't have any interest in cycling at that point. And we had moved... So we had moved back to Sacramento after living in Redlands for a year. And then the following year, then we went back down. That's when I had started racing. The Redlands Classic, I did that crit. And that, I think that was my second crit. I think that was my second bike race that I had ever done. So we came back down to Redlands, did that crit. And I just couldn't believe how much fun racing was. It was this combination of total exertion and at the same time requiring thought and you know, not so much as a Cat 5, but still, there's still so much to think about. And there's nothing I had ever done that demanded that much of myself. And so from that point, then I was, you know, I started racing more, getting more involved. I met a guy, Dave Hasselman, who was racing with Rio Strada. He got first in the Winty Criterium. I got third. He was from the Sacramento area, and so I joined the Rio Strada racing team and then met a lot of my friends that year and the following year that are still really good friends of mine and that, you know, kind of form the core of our small team.
So I'll get into how you kind of got into coaching, but yeah. to bring Travis into this, I know you guys went to college together and there was some – Travis, you had been involved in cycling. When did you get involved? Because – we were shunned by Nate at the time, right?
Yeah. So Nate and I mean, he was, you know, he grew up in kind of the Napa Valley. I grew up in Chico, Paradise area. So the schools that we played against, our paths would cross playing basketball. And he was a grade or two ahead of me. So
I think two years.
Yeah, 2 years. So we basically we went to college with the same major, took a lot of classes. I think I was playing basketball it was after maybe midway through the second year, so I guess I was around 2005, 2004 is when I first kind of got into cycling, and I did it more for just off-season workouts because I hated running. So, you know, now come to find out, cycling didn't really help me with my basketball fitness, but I enjoyed it. I actually got into it to ride with my dad. He wanted to do centuries. I was like, yeah, why not? It'd be fun. He had this old Bridgestone Kabuki. So you talk about the efficiency on a bike.
Think of naming a bike the Kabuki, though. I don't know that there's so much. We're getting close to the E on our podcast here, yeah. The Kabuki.
I think that was the name of this thing. And he had this thing tuned up, so I took it out for a ride, and oh my goodness, it was nowhere near the efficiency on the newer bikes. And I went and rode the Specialized Delay triple chainring, and that was the bike I ended up getting, and I rode that for years.
The triple?
Yeah, I had a triple, and then when I started racing, I modified it to a double.
Yeah, you can't race with a triple.
Did you try to influence him, Nate, to race in college?
No. I remember distinctly getting made fun of. Nothing too bad. We had a mutual friend, and we'd always just kind of joke around in class. We always took it seriously. Wink, wink.
Well, we were both taking undergraduate exercise physiology, I think is what it was. So we would sit at the back and, you know, always just constant jokes, inappropriateness of the class.
Yeah, that's right.
And all I remember is I think you probably came into class a couple times with your cycling kit on. Or you were leaving or something like that.
I did a presentation on, you know, you had to do that biomechanical analysis.
Quote biomechanical.
Yeah, right. So we did full suspension versus no suspension, mountain bike down, going downstairs.
Do you remember, was that with Braulio? Do you remember Braulio?
No, it was Mike Ford.
Okay, yeah, I remember Mike.
Yeah. So
because he was on the basketball team too.
He was. Yeah. He used to mountain bike downhill, so of course he got to ride these bikes down the stairs because I wasn't about to.
Yeah.
And our professor was a big cyclist, and I started riding with him. And I went to Loma Linda. I started riding with the Redlands team down there, and that's kind of when I got into racing.
So when did you first race? What was your first race?
My first. I can't even remember the name of it.
It was probably a crit. Travis is known as a crit dog.
Yeah, crit. He's a crit dog.
Crit monster.
It actually was a crit. Wow. Top 5 crit out in Riverside, or past Riverside. I don't think it was a USA Cycling sponsored event. So
it was a fake race.
Grand Fondo crit. Yeah,
exactly. It was one of those like big, long, straightaway, four-corner crits.
Yeah.
I did well. I had a lot of fun. And yeah, that was back when I thought climbing was different than Southern California climbing is a lot different than Northern California climbing.
Well,
that's the best way to put it. Yeah.
What do you mean by that? Because in Southern California, there's really good climbs, obviously, and there's good ones here in Northern California. So you just maybe where you were at.
Yeah, I would say that where I rode. I mean, there's some great climbs around there, but most of the guys just kind of avoided them. It's just a lot of the guys that were, at least were in those clubs down there that I rode with, were more into grits and the flatter racing.
So, yeah. So, yeah.
Then I came up here, you know, became a physical therapist, kind of went away from racing for a little bit, but our paths would always cross at the Tour of California. Run into him randomly. You know, I think I saw him after a crash, he'd broken his thumb or his wrist or something. Yeah.
Did you see him on TV in his Borat underwear?
I had forgotten about that. I can share that picture with you. I still have those pictures. That's something I was proud about.
Okay.
I wasn't shaving my legs yet then. That was still very early in my cycling career.
And look, we'll get about your triumphant game. I know that's a big deal, but what's your feeling on when you first shaved your legs? I remember, you know, growing up much like you guys, where my father is really big into the all three sports, and now you've got a teenage son. I started, you know, high school earlier, shaving. You know, he's obviously questioning where you're going with this, and the reality is it was biking, Dad. But, I mean, were there problems with your family? You had a wife. Was she objecting to you shaving your legs?
I think she gave me a little bit of shit initially, kind of like, I've heard this from clients, too, or that said, oh, like, you know, my wife, it's weird or whatever. But not that much. It was actually for my my friend Mark Heide. We were doing a bachelor party ride. And I think it was shortly around there or whatever, I was like, hey, like I finally got to go all in and like shave my legs. But I think for me too, I waited to do it because I felt like I had to, my proficiency on the bike needed to at some level match what I felt shaving your legs represented.
Yeah.
So for me, it was just once I started, you know, once I felt like it lined up to my commitment to the bike, then it was just, it was just kind of a natural thing.
I stopped riding for about 10 years there, and I maybe all but three I still shaved, just holding on to any hope. You know, it's
whenever
like that girl from the hope comes back.
Whenever I've stopped riding, I have stopped shaving my legs because it's that same thing. It's that symbolic thing of like, this is it.
All right, so you've matured more than I have.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, okay. So now you get into how you decided. I know you were a high school basketball coach, and you worked at a grade school, high school, doing all kinds of coaching, and then you transferred into full-time cycling, fitness coaching, data-driven athlete.
Yeah.
How did that transformation take place? Because that's obviously starting your own business is a big step, big bold step, and then you've got cycling where it's not necessary for someone to go out and hire a coach. So
sure, yeah, it's by any measure, it's a much less stable form of, you know, of income. But yeah, so I was riding more and more, and I kind of had this epiphany. I'd been teaching for a couple years, and I kind of had this epiphany of I want to somehow be able, I want cycling to somehow be a bigger part of my life professionally. And I want to be around the sport more. I want to be able to have more of those conversations with people. I want to be able to ride, be able to ride more myself. I want it to be a bigger deal. And so at that point, I started seeing the writing on the wall a little bit in terms of my teaching job, where the expectations on me and the amount of time that was required out of that job, I could look into the future and I could see that there was just no way that when my wife and I finally had kids, that was going to work for us and for our lifestyle. So I began, after teaching for 3 years, I started looking at cycling coaching, and I just kind of jumped into it full speed. I was still teaching part-time at that point, but I wanted to try and learn as much as I could, and try and be as good as I, try and improve my qualifications and my knowledge base as well as I could.
What is your qualifications now? And just real quickly, how are those delineated out with the USA Cycling?
Yeah, so, to be a USA Cycling coach, there really aren't any qualifications. Some basic certification standards from a USA Cycling Level 3 coach, which is, you can go online and take a very basic exam and then have that certification. And then there's a level 2 certification, which involves a weekend long clinic. And then the highest level of certification is a level 1. And to achieve that, you have to go to USA Cycling headquarters, where they have a multi-day conference certification,
where you compete against other coaches, right?
Yeah. So that, and then in addition, you have to have been a USA Cycling Level 2 coach for 5 years. So the barrier of entry for a cycling coach, I think the positive and maybe the negative in some cases too, is that, there really isn't a barrier of entry. If you love the sport of cycling and you're interested in coaching and helping people, you can get involved with it. So for me, my journey was a little bit different in that I had a bachelor's degree in exercise science. And I felt really fortunate in that I think segued really well into cycling coaching full time, because when I saw that I really wanted to take it more seriously, I wanted to go back to graduate school, get my master's degree in exercise physiology. So as I began transitioning, I was teaching part time, I was going to graduate school full time, and then I was continuing to coach more and more. And that kind of, I think, segues well into some of the liver transplant stuff, because at that same time, I was also getting sicker and sicker.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up. I remember you were doing this big study for your graduate school, your master's, and during that whole time, you were obviously had some blood level issues. Matter of fact, Cascade Cycling Classic is coming up this next week, which you're going to. You're obviously, you and Travis both looking good. But I remember you going up there being Cat 3 and then going up the next year just as a spectator and kind of being a waif of your former self.
Yeah, so I was just finishing up my graduate degree, just finishing up my research. Our daughter was born, and at that time I was still trying to race and trying to train at some level, but my health was deteriorating so quickly that...
And what can you go into? What is your health issue?
So I have a liver disease called primary sclerosing cholangitis. And in really simple terms, what that does is it creates scarring in your bile ducts. And so once your bile ducts begin scarred, your body's not able to drain out that bile. And then that creates further inflammation and scarring of your liver. And then, you die. So it really, really, really positive.
This is not a prison scarring related joke,
yeah.
Right?
So my health was deteriorating. And the great thing about cycling coaching is that at the time I wasn't teaching, I was coaching full time. And so I could manage the level of energy that I had, and I could still do a really good job with my clients, but I didn't have to go to a job, which increasingly I probably wouldn't have been able to do. So at that time I was taking care of my daughter at home. My wife was working full time and I was coaching. And then around Cascade, I had done some different tests in preparation for my transplant, and the test revealed that I had severe osteoporosis in a couple different spots. And so that year, if you remember, I did the Cal Aggie crit with our team. It was the first year for our team. And then after that crit, I think the next week or so, I had these tests done. And at that point, I realized that I probably still would have tried to race, even though I wouldn't have been able to do it well. But I realized that if I were to crash and break something significantly, really my primary role at that point was to take care of my daughter at home. So if I couldn't fulfill that role, I really had no value.
So that goes kind of into some issues you've done currently with your training, which is running, your bone density. So that was the big issue then. Falling, maybe really hurting yourself in a sense. Really, you're running?
Yeah, well, so, you know, so, I mean, cycling in general, cyclists in general, a healthy cycling population, there's a much greater risk for osteoporosis and osteopenia. So for me, even post-transplant, having some bone scans done revealed that that osteoporosis really hadn't gotten much better. So rather than go on some bone-building medications, I kind of made a deal with my doctor to say, hey, how about if I try and introduce some more impact to my training, and then let's check and see if that's improved.
Is that always going to be? Look, masters racers, they're notorious for, you know, you could spot them out because they're the hunchback guy that just is on his bike doing no impact. But is that something that's just related to your health issues in general, or is it because you're a cyclist?
Well, I think both. I think if you're a master cyclist and you're not paying attention to your bone density, I think you're probably being willfully irresponsible.
Yeah.
For me, already having bone density issues from liver disease, I think it's an even greater, you know, I'd be crazy to not try and incorporate some of that stuff. So I've made some significant, I've made some dietary changes in addition to impact. And my hope is that, you know, maybe in the next year when I have another scan done, maybe there's been some improvement there. But so at that time I decided I wasn't going to race. It wasn't worth that risk. And I probably would have been forced to do that anyways because my health began spiraling really, really rapidly. So I was listed on the organ transplant list in February. So Cal Aggie was, I think, end of January. I was listed for an organ transplant in February, and then were able to, instead of waiting on the transplant list in California, which can be multiple years, and you get, you know, a lot of people die because they the supply in the demand for organ transplants in California is more intense than any other point in the country. You'd have to check that, but I'm pretty sure that's accurate. So I was lucky enough to where I was able to have a live donor transplant, which enables you to essentially opt out of that waiting system. So the transplant can be, if you can find someone that is willing to do that, you don't have to wait for the transplant. It can be scheduled, and it can be, you know, it can literally be a lifesaver.
So, and you got Jacob Heinrich to do that, which was one of your former students and who's now into racing with the Data Driven Athlete Team.
Yeah, really, really cool. So Jacob, I coached both Jacob and his brother at basketball. And, you know, that's a long story in and of itself. But, yeah, Jacob volunteered to be a live liver donor for me. And so, so after, you know, leading into Cascade, I was just up there to kind of support the team. And honestly, it was really as the date was more quickly approaching for my liver transplant, I needed something to do that had nothing to do with how terrible my health was. Like, I didn't want to go to a transplant support group. I didn't want to. So to be around you guys racing at a bike race where you couldn't draw a further contrast from what I was about to have done to what everyone else is doing up there. And that is, everyone's in incredible shape in the racing. So that was a great.
And Andrew was on the ground like about two or three times.
Yeah.
Heard that story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was right next to the road when he hit the deck on the circuit race. And that was, it was not fun, but.
All right. So let's transition into, you've got a liver. You're doing great. You just had some ups and downs with that,
sure.
But you decided to take this to a different level. Well, first of all, you're back racing with, I haven't had any transplants. I was going to use the word normal, but let's not.
You
let's
can
not,
use normal. That
let's
works.
Not go there. So you're racing with, you're a Cat 2. You're very strong. But you've also decided to go back into this, the transplant games. I didn't know anything about this. Could you explain how long this has been going on, as far as you know, and how often they have it and what it entails?
Yeah. So this year, I think, was the 25th, 26th. I don't remember exactly. Edition. I think the transplant games go back to maybe the late 70s. So if I made a mistake on any of these dates, you'll have to check them out. But so basically, the transplant games was created to kind of to provide a more vibrant option or kind of a more vibrant picture of what post transplant health can be. So for me, that was really significant in that when the moment that I knew I was going to be having a transplant, I was looking for stories and images of people post-transplant.
Yeah.
And for me, as a competitor and as an athlete, I wanted to see examples that people were competing and that they were living really vibrant, competitive lives.
You didn't want to just say, hey, I'm able to go back to the office and sit at my desk. You wanted to go above. You wanted to throw it down on the bike.
Yeah, I was starved for those kind of stories, and I wanted to believe that that was possible. So probably the biggest name in that is Chris Klug, who is a Winter Games Olympian. So he was a snowboarder. He was also had primary sclerosis and cholangitis, had a liver transplant, and then won a bronze medal in, I think, slalom snowboard in the Salt Lake City Games. Oh. So he's kind of the I would say the biggest name in post transplant health for kind of what's achievable.
Can you beat him on a bike though?
Yeah. I don't know. Probably. Oh. I mean, that's the thing. If you don't ride a bike, you can't just get on a bike and But so that was a story that was significant to me, but also. Reading about these transplant games was also really significant to me because it gave me kind of a benchmark that existed outside the competitiveness of local and regional racing that we were doing as a team, And even though I knew I wanted to get back at that level, I didn't know if I ever really could. I didn't have any stories of people. I don't know anyone that races USA Cycling. And I'm sure they're out there, but I don't know anyone personally that races USA Cycling competitively that has had an organ transplant. So for me, it was kind of these two benchmarks of this is the transplant games and I want to get back and I want to compete there. And then let's just see what happens. And if I'm doing really well, then I also want this other way to gauge my progress in terms of USA Cycling type races. So.
So you first did one, how many years? First of all, is it every other year? Is that my
Yes, name? every 2 years, the World Transplant Games is held.
And this is a world, international?
Yeah, it's international competition, and, it's open to anyone who's had, any of the major transplants. So that's heart, lung, liver, kidney, I think I've covered all those. So, yeah, so any major transplant, then it's open to those people.
So you did one 2 years ago, first one.
Yeah, two years ago in Argentina.
How'd that go?
That went really well. So that was 2 years, just about 2 years post-transplant. And that was always my benchmark. It was kind of like if you kind of rewind it a little bit more, it was the U.S. transplant games. And that was in Houston. This is maybe 4 years, 3 years ago now. So that was just about, I was barely eligible to race in the U.S. transplant games. So that was about 10 months post-transplant.
When you say eligible, is there a limit on when you can compete after your transplant?
Yeah, you have to have had a viable transplant for, I think it's 10 months. Your transplant has to have been viable for at least 10 months before you can
even just compete. A safety issue?
Yeah, it's a safety issue so you don't have, people that maybe the transplant hasn't really taken. So for me, I had kind of drawn out this, arc for myself, and that was that I started racing USA Cycling races with Kurt Mills, who was decided to not show up today.
Well, so once my again, first I, we're, race we're back, still hoping he's okay.
Yeah, I'm hoping he did not have a transplant. I don't know where he's at. So, my first race back was with Kurt and our friend Casey at one of the stage races in Central California. Do you remember which one that is? It's a TT little crit. It's like out in Merced.
There's a Merced one.
It's not Merced though. It's Madera. That's what it is. Madera.
It's an M.
So my first race back was Madera, and that was maybe only about 6 months post transplant. So kind of the what I had drawn out for myself is that I'm going to get back into racing. I'm going to go do the U.S. transplant games, and then after the U.S. transplant games, the next year I'm going to get ready and I'm going to try and be really good at the World Transplant Games. That was in Argentina, and then after the World Transplant Games, I said, okay. I want to prove that I can compete in USA Cycling races. That had been 2 years now post-transplant. And so that was kind of the progression that I had looked at, had kind of set out for myself. But the World Transplant Games the whole time, it provides a great measure because it's easy to race in USA Cycling and to forget that there are different obstacles to you training and to getting better. And it's easy to feel frustrated when you're racing against people that aren't, maybe having to tackle some of those same obstacles. So the World Transplant Games was helpful in that it was like it gave me this. There's these two tracks to measure my progress. There was the realistic one, which was transplant patients, and then there was the hyper competitiveness of USA Cycling that drove me to be as good as I could be.
So you did win the national one in Houston, is that correct?
Yeah. So I won.
And explain the there's two events, I believe.
For people that are just versed in USA Cycling races, so transplant events are understandably much shorter. And the reason for that is that they want to encourage people who maybe are maybe in very ill health or maybe have just been recovering from a transplant, and they want them to be able to complete those races. So it's comprised of a time trial, a really, really short time trial that's 5K, and then a really short road race that's 20K. So if you're only accustomed to USA Cycling races, you look at those distances and you say, oh, those are really short. Well, yeah, well, if you've had a double lung transplant, like that might not be that short for you.
Yeah, yeah.
If you had a liver transplant and you almost died, you know, 5K, that can be maybe the longest you've ever ridden on a bike. So
with that said, though, you are competing against, I mean, tell me about the level of competitors at the national compared to the level of competitors international.
Yeah. So the level of competitor, you know, obviously the international competition is much better. But what my hope has always been at these events is to raise the level of what it takes to be good at those events. And so you have a spectrum of people who maybe are just happy to be there and they're happy to experience an athletic competition and they're inspired by all these people there. And then you have people at the other end that have been training maybe for the whole year and who are really competitive and who want to win. And those are the people that I'm always most inspired with, is that people who don't define themselves by this trauma that happened to them as a transplant, but they define themselves by what they've done after that transplant and what they're wanting to accomplish. And for me, I want to line up with other transplant patients or healthy racers who want to destroy me. Like, there's nothing more energizing and fun to me than that. You know?
Yeah, it's fun for us too.
Yeah. Everybody. Nice. So you'll find that spectrum. I'd say that spectrum is in the national transplant games. That spectrum is not as wide. It's more tilted. Now, other countries aren't like that. I don't think are as much like that. But at least for the U.S. transplant games, I think it's tilted more towards participation. Whereas at the international transplant games, it's much more tilted towards people who are dedicated to being as good of an athlete as they can, not just in cycling, but in the other.
So We're talking about the competition level of the two, and obviously your proclivity for the international based on the fact that it's a little more competitive.
Yeah. So I don't know if I would do the national games again, because I don't think that the event is geared towards people like me. I think it could be, and I hope
neurotic.
I think that it could be, and I hope that it is one day. But I realized the last time I went last year was that the event is not for people who are highly competitive. The event more is for people who want to experience participation at an event, and that's great. But that's not what brought me back from death. You know, like what brought me back from death was wanting to ride better than I ever have in my life before. It wasn't just, I just want to participate in an event, you know?
Yeah, but with that said, that game, like you said, it's very important for a lot of those people.
And it was important for me too.
They didn't, yeah, exactly, initially.
Yeah.
And as you said, now it's maybe not so much. So back to the international, your results in Argentina, you ended up winning both of those.
Yeah.
By record smashing times, or how did those go? And how was that whole setup?
Yeah.
As far as the games, you know, is it similar to, you go to the Olympics, you have all the people come in with their flags?
Yeah. So Argentina was really cool. It was, that was a big target of mine. I had been thinking about going to the World Transplant Games, you know, probably for a couple of years before I even had my transplant. So to be healthy enough to be there, I had had some pretty significant complications. And I didn't know if I'd be healthy enough to be there. So just to be healthy enough to be there, to experience it, it's a totally different level of energy at a place like that, where you have this shared experience of thousands of people that would all be dead if it wasn't for transplantation.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a different feeling. You know, you go to a USA Cycling race and everybody's warming up on their trainer and everybody wants to kill each other. And I like that. I love that energy. That's positive energy to me.
Yeah. Well.
But so the World Transplant Games is different in that you have that. And I think there's still that gamesmanship, but there's also this shared appreciation for, oh my God, I can't believe how lucky I am to be here. So I was in really good shape. I was in the best shape I had been 2 years post transplant, and I was able to win both the races that I was in. The organization is really cool. I got to have a chance to watch other events and to watch other athletes who I would consider to be are the best, you know, some of the different swimmers, some of the different track athletes. Obviously, the best athletes are, it's hard to be really good having had a transplant, right? So it's not like an Olympic competition where you have, you know, 20 people who are vying for the best spot and who are just marginally better than someone else. Sometimes that happens, but you know, the people who really dedicate themselves to the sport are gonna stand out, you know, because maybe they got lucky because 2 years they didn't have some major complication and they were able to train. You know, maybe, you know, the next guy next to you, maybe he really wanted to train for 2 years, but maybe he had some severe complications and he was in the hospital. So it's a totally different, you know, just the consistency of training for most people is very different. To say nothing of everyone being on immunosuppression therapy, you know, all the other obstacles, you know, to training consistently and to training well. So if you, to me, if you can show up to one of those events and you've been healthy, I'll take that, right? I mean, that's I think anybody would take that.
So Argentina was a great success. I mean, yeah. There was some disappointment. I know you came home and lost a bunch of your KOMs while you were gone. Chris Flowers just stepped into the room. He was part of that debacle.
Yes. So I was in my hotel room, and I don't remember. It was maybe 3 o'clock in the middle of the night, and I saw Chris's name pop up on my phone. But it said, I think maybe because of the length of his name, I just saw CHRAS or whatever. And I see this, like, someone stolen your KOM. And I'm thinking to myself, and this is a KOM right next to my house that you could only know about if you were specifically, probably if you were specifically targeting me. So I look
which did, yeah, may or may not have happened.
So I look at my phone and then I start thinking about it. And then I'm like, I thought it was so, again, this is what I love about competition. I thought it was hilarious and awesome that, like, and I knew what they were doing as I was out of the country. They were sliding in under the sleuth of night, trying to steal these KOMs. And the notification popped up on my phone like the night before the race. So another beautiful thing about cycling and Strava is to get beaten and have someone take you down is fun and exciting and motivating. Like that's what's always drawn me into the sport, you know?
Or the complete opposite.
Yeah, or demoralizing.
Yeah.
One of my good friends growing up was a tremendous sprinter, and he had all this power, and you'd get done with a race, and all he would say is, oh, that, you know, the how much that hurt. And, you know, after 10 minutes after you're done with the race, sometimes you forget all that. And I think that's what you need, sometimes that short-term memory loss or long-term memory loss, one of the memory losses, to kind of continue on.
Yeah.
Okay. So now you've decided 2 years on, skipping nationals again, I guess, and going on for the World Transplant Games in Spain this time. What did you do to prepare yourself for this one, knowing the competition that you had last time and expecting, I imagine, that it was going to be a little bit more stiff? And so what did your whole process for training go for
that? Yeah. So, you know, I knew I wanted to go back to Spain. I had gotten, you know, in the 2 to 3 years post transplant, I had continued to ride better than I ever had pre transplant. So
some ups and downs though.
Some ups and downs. You know, I was hospitalized for a while, but in between those downs, my trajectory was still that I was getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And I think probably some of that was leading up to my transplant. Probably even 2 years leading into my transplant, I was not able to progress as a cyclist because my body just, I was maxing out on how I could progress because my body, I was just slowly dying basically leading the transplant. So post transplant, I'm just continuing to get better. You know, last year was, you know, was really exciting for me to get my upgrade and to, you know, to do well. And so, you know, this year I knew that I wanted to go back to the World Transplant Games, and you don't know who might be there, right? It's not like a local crit, or it's not like a world championship event where you have a bead on everybody that's been there. You know,
some guy in the last 2 years may have
gotten
a new liver.
Exactly. Some guy. So there's no way to feel comfortable about showing up and saying, hey, I did really well at the last one, and so I expect that I'm going to do well there. And that is what really drives me, is that, like, however anybody else, whoever else shows up, that I will have gotten better, or I will have, if I haven't gotten better, I've maximized the time that I've had to get better. That I can show up there on that event and I can say, now I'm comfortable. I'm comfortable with everything that I've done. If somebody shows up and they beat me.
But did you alter, because look, you said 5K TT, yeah. 20K road race, which I'm imagining, we'll get into that, but I'm imagining you rode a 5K TT and a 20K TT.
Yeah.
Or I mean,
no, I didn't actually.
Well, you did it in Argentina.
In Argentina, I did.
But did you train specifically for those and kind of cut your own training and to modify it directly for those?
No, I didn't. So what my plan was in both of those races is that I kind of knew where I was on track over that 5K duration. So the 5K duration you're talking about, you know, like somewhere around 6 to 7
flat.
Minutes or so. Flat, yeah. So around 6 or 7 minutes, I was, you know, I could see what was happening as I continued to get stronger to my power output over those durations. And that was enough for me. If I wasn't continuing to get better over those durations, then I probably would have tried to do some specific kind of focus stuff. But for me, and this is one of the kind of philosophies that I use with my clients, is that I want to get better with the least effort possible. So if I'm continuing to get better with the amount of training time I have while doing intensity that's less, you know, psychologically demanding, then I'm going to choose that path as opposed to doing a ton of intervals that might produce maybe marginally better results, but that might be much more demanding, you know, emotionally and psychologically. So for me, looking at those different margins and seeing that I was continuing to progress, you know, even this year, continuing to hit, you know, new peak power outputs over the shorter durations, I was comfortable with that. And I also realized too that there's something exciting about going into a race and not knowing exactly what you can do, right? So rather than
we do that all the time.
No, but I mean rather than going in and having tested, you know, that exact 5K duration to say, hey, you know what? I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that I can commit to riding is absolutely as hard as I can, and then I'm comfortable with that. And then maybe because this has happened to me this last year, going after some different segments, I hit power PRs where if I would have paced myself, I never would have been able to achieve those power PRs because I wouldn't have actually thought I was capable of doing that. So going into it kind of with this possibility was what my strategy was to say, I think I can do around this, but I'm just going to ride. And honestly, over that duration too, you just ride as hard as you absolutely can.
Yeah. So we've talked about doing TTs before, you and me personally, and, you know, cutting them up into like quadrants, you know, quadrant 1 through 4 and how you want to pace yourself. Sounds like you just said, I've got one big quadrant. It's 5K. Yeah,
exactly.
What do I? So how did that go? How did the TT go for you?
Yeah. It's one big quadrant. And for me, I was just like, I'm just going to try and hit 400 and then I'm just going to hang on 400 until I absolutely die. And you can't really make a mistake in pacing yourself over that duration.
So for this non-cycling person, that's not 400 miles an hour. That's wattage that you're talking about, power output on your bike. Yeah. So how I
approached it was, this one was a little bit different because there was a whole bunch of roundabouts. So it wasn't really possible to find much of a rhythm. It's like we came down a slight downhill and then a sharp corner. To talk about the course, I looked at the course the previous day. And my first thought was, this is unfair to that spectrum of transplant competitors here. So when we talked about that we talked about that spectrum before, where you have people who are there to participate in an event, and you have people who have trained for 2 years to be really good there. And I looked at the course, and just to give, it was more technical than you'd find in any pro TT course. I mean, you could look at it and you could say it has 2 180s, it's got 2 90s, and it's got 3 roundabouts. So there's a couple different crashes on it.
I saw on Twitter the other day, the last stage of the tour where Barguil won.
Yeah.
One of the commentators put on Twitter that the last corner was a 360 degree. Oh. I think he meant 180.
Yeah.
So I don't think you had any 360s, although the roundabout you could have just continued back.
So
were all those turns in a 5K?
Yes. Those are all in 5K.
It's a spaghetti stream right there.
So, and this is one of the frustrations, is that at these international competitions, sometimes there's not as much thought for anyone that races locally in USA Cycling races. You should be immensely appreciative of any race course that people cobble together.
Yeah,
because at this level, and this happened to Argentina too, you have people that are looking at it and they're basically trying to piece together a distance for a TT. And they're not really taking into account the quality of that course. It's just like, if we did that, then we'll get the 5K.
Yeah.
And it was obvious that that's what had gone down on this course. And one of the guys from the USA team, he came the first corner And boom, went down, broke his collarbone. I think he's still in the hospital because he broke a rib. And so I'm coming down the first corner, and all the marshals are like, you know, giving me slow down. And I'm looking at them. I'm like,
maybe not this time.
I'm like, you don't know. Like, I'm fine. Like, I got this.
Did you bunny hop in or something?
Or no, I just came in, and there was probably four or five people, and they were all just giving me the head signs. And I knew the corner, and
were you able to pre-ride?
I had pre-ridden it, and you know, I wasn't being unsafe, but you know, anyone that's ridden a bunch of criteriums, you're going to have a different level of comfort with that than.
And you rode your regular road bike as a Frankenstein TT bike, right?
So yeah.
The mobility and the ability. Your angling and everything was probably
okay. Yeah, I rode that. I had the aero bars on there. Yeah. So
I've seen the pictures.
Yeah, which is another. There's something so defiling to put aero bars on a great road bike. I almost didn't do it just because it feels. I don't know. Yeah. So anyway, I had the aero bars on there, and then I didn't do quite as well power output wise as I had hoped, but I felt good. You know, my power output was probably 20 or 30 watts over that duration, higher than it was 2 years ago. And it was pretty hot there, and you know, but yeah, it was awesome to, again, just to be there, to be healthy enough to be there. And then for your bike to be in one piece, right? Cause that I stress about that. You're flying internationally. You've got to take significant parts of it apart. You got to put it back together. I had to ride from our hotel to the course, got a flat tire right before, you know, a little bit before the race started.
On the ride over?
Yeah, on the ride over.
And was your wife there with you to help that? What did you do on
because
that? That's one of my biggest stress.
Okay, so because I am so obsessive, on the way over, I had a backpack. And in that backpack, I had a full complement of tools, torque wrenches, extra valves. There was no way. Basically,
just changed your tube there.
Yeah, but I changed the tube, and then the valve stem came out because I was using the 80s. So then I had a backup extender. But for me, again, in terms of preparation, all my preparation for it was save somebody hitting me in a car or me getting a flat in the middle of the race. There is no variable that I'm going to miss here. There's no detail that is going to come between me just having a chance to ride as hard as I can.
Yeah. Yeah. So you won. Right?
Yeah.
And what was the, now you've told me before there's age groups in there. Do you want to explain that real quick about the different age categories? And then is there even an overall category
that's
just your desire? Maybe.
So there's different age categories, and you know, it was broken up by age and then gender as well. So I won the age group, but for me, I feel like I'm of pretty much peak cycling performance age. You know, you could say I'm a little bit older, but you know, most endurance athletes who are at their best, you're talking about 30s, you know, something like that. So I feel like it's not satisfying for me to just win my age group when I feel like physically of the age I am, I'm at the peak of endurance, you know, endurance potential. So for me, you know, winning my age category was not really, I wanted to have the best time overall.
And did you?
Yeah, so I was able to get that, and
was it close? What was the can you give us an idea what the first and second?
I'd have to look. I think the second guy to me might have been 35 to 40 seconds off.
It's good competition then for you.
Yeah. So it was, and that was much better. That was actually the same margin as had been in Argentina, but it was the best that it's ever been. So there were a lot of people there that had medaled at, you know, previous games for, you know, 10 years that showed up to Spain and that didn't medal at all. And to me, that's the most exciting thing. That's what I want to be a part of.
There's a progression.
There's a progression where it's like, and again, there's still that spectrum to where if you want to participate in an incredible event, you can do that. But for me, it's about saying to people, it's about hopefully kind of embodying this, that if that the rewards for working really, really hard as a transplant athlete are much better than working kind of hard, you know?
Yeah.
That it's cool to maybe show up to an event and maybe the competition's not that great, so you get a medal, but it's way better if everyone works for 2 years to be really good. And what you experience out of life in that moment from working that hard is amazing and it's incredible. And that's what I hope the progression of all, and I was talking to other transplant, I was talking with other transplant athletes there as well in different sports, is that all the different sports are trending in that way to say, hey, if you want a medal, you have to bring it. You know, like you can't just show up anymore and medal. And maybe for some people that might be discouraging. But for me, that that reality is exciting. And yeah, that's what I've always loved most.
They're still allowing those people to show
up.
Of
course, everyone can show up and everyone can participate.
I mean, what was your qualifications just for...
None.
Yeah. So you had to buy your own skin suit.
Yeah. So that's not the same for other countries. So other countries that take it much more seriously, they have to win their, you know, their national games. And then there's a selection process for some of those, which I think is really cool.
What it does for those people is then when they do get to the transplant, the big international world games, it makes it more of a bigger event because they've had to qualify to get there.
Yeah. And kind of talking about that spectrum again, I think that the beauty of the World Transplant Games, hopefully, is that it continues to progress, is that it encompasses the person who wants to travel to a cool country and to be around and be inspired by a bunch of transplant athletes and to maybe show up for an event and just to do it.
Yeah. Did you make friends with like your teammates, other countries?
Yeah. So I've, for, you know, this being my second time there, I've met a lot of incredible people. I mean, it's amazing to, after a race, to be talking with somebody and they're telling you, well, I'd say to an extent. So I don't like, it can get very burdensome to talk transplant shit all the time. So to constantly talk and to constantly kind of invest in everyone's transplant story. But for the most part, these events are not like that. These events are, tell me about your kids. Like, what about, you know, what have you been doing on the bike? What have you been? And then, you know, if someone's going to talk about, you know, kind of what happened to them on their transplant, then that happens. But, you know, to talk with people after the race who, you know, one guy from the Netherlands, he's, you know, a double lung transplant patient. I have no idea what that would be like. I know what my experience has been like as a liver transplant patient. But what is it like to compete having two transplanted lungs in an endurance sport?
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know? And that's just one person. That's just one other person. You could go down the line of, I think in Spain there were, you know, 2,300 people there or whatever. You go down the line of all these people, some multiple organ transplants. There was a woman from the U.S. who, I think she was in the 70-plus category. She had to petition just to get into the transplant games because her transplant happened outside that window to be eligible to compete. She was I think she was a liver transplant patient. She had done ultra marathons, all kinds of, it sounds like she had been a really, really legit endurance athlete. And she's 7 years old. She comes there by herself. She rents a bike there. I'm helping her set up her bike before, a couple days before the games. The bike doesn't fit her. And she is just, she's a beast. She's there doing it. And this is what I loved best about this woman. So she's talking to the other people on the team and she's like, I really feel embarrassed that you had to see me at this state. Like, basically what she was saying is, I'm a really good endurance athlete. And like, it's kind of embarrassing that I'm competing at this level. And this is a woman that was like less than 10 months post-transplant.
Wow. Yeah.
So those are the kind of people that you get to, have experiences with and to talk with. And again, it's not something that I think anybody could do. They couldn't hang out in that environment all the time, but to do it every 2 years and to meet people from other countries who have similar stories is an incredible experience. And, you know, especially this year, my wife, Christy, wasn't able to come with me to Argentina, but she was there this year. And it was, you know, my wife has been there for the worst of everything of my transplant experience. And my wife has never seen me win a bike race. So my USA Cycling races that I, you know, the couple of them that I've had success in, you know, she was taking care of our kids. She wasn't there in Argentina. So for her to be there at kind of this, you know, at the completely different spectrum of transplant health was awesome.
Well, you had a good 2016. You did win several bike races. So.
Well, whatever.
I mean, she wasn't there.
Yeah.
On the road race. Now you mentioned all these other athletes.
Yeah.
Did you have teammates for the road race? Any other USA participants?
No. So in our age category, our age category was mixed. So it was eight. So the age category is 18 to 29, and then and then 30 to 39 or something like that. So they mix those, they mix those two groups together, and there's no other younger USA cyclists.
So how did that road race go? Walk us through the,
yeah, so
the grueling 20K. Anyway, I didn't mean to diminish it, but.
Well, again, this is the thing. It's like, I get it. People talk to me, they're like, how long is a road race? And I tell them, you know, I say, yeah, it's really short. It's 20K. They say 20K. That's not even the length of a crit. And it's like, yeah, it's not, but you have a double lung transplant and then yeah. You do 20K.
Yeah.
Like then come and talk to me about that distance. So sure. You know?
And I don't mean to diminish.
No, I know you're not. I know you're
especially
not.
Especially when we just, it. You know, you just did the death ride.
Yeah.
Which for, you know, it's a non USA cycling event, but it's brutal. It's 130 miles. How many thousand feet of climbing?
Yeah.
This is not your 20K race.
Well, exactly. Well, and I think too, when people, because I race locally and that distance also to me is foreign to me, right? I don't know if I've ever even ridden. I don't even know if I've ever been on the bike and ridden 20K. Like, I usually don't do those kind of rides. I'm going to ride longer if I have the time. So
I do those all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So I get it. I get it. When you're talking to people who are familiar with USA Cycling road races, you hear that, and then but I just have to you know, give the caveat to. Again, this is about capturing a spectrum of transplant health.
Sure.
To somebody who's 70 years old and who's never even ridden 20K on a bike, but who wants to be there in that environment and who completes 20K, and in some ways that 20K is marathon-like, to the other end of the spectrum of people that are going all out over the 20K, and it's just like a crit. It's just like a 30-minute crit would be. You know, it's like a 30-minute crit is not necessarily any easier than, you know, a 90-minute crit. It just depends on how hard you're doing it.
Right? Which just sounds like you're doing a 30-minute crit.
It's going to be 45, I believe. So
I think it's going to be 35.
Yeah, I think it was like 35 last year.
So, yeah, so in the road race, for me, I really felt like my biggest strength, kind of talking about the distance of those races, my biggest strength is my endurance. And my biggest strength is that I don't train for those distances. I train for, USA Cycling race distances. So I really felt like, and this is the way I felt in Argentina, is that the best way I could approach that race would be to make it as absolutely hard as possible. So to try and make those 20K feel like 40K or 60K. And the way to do that on a flat course is that you just have to be, I feel you have to just be as aggressive as possible. So we're lining up for the race, and I did this in Argentina too, and I do this in local crits too, but I always want to be, if you want to be aggressive from the start, you know, you should be first on the line. So it's just like for anybody that's done Nevada City or the Cascade Crit. The Cascade Crit, I think our field's going to be full at 130. Like, you should probably be paying attention to your start time and then come behind the gates and then try and get out there if you want to have, you know, a marginal, a marginally better starting spot and have a little bit better chance. So I'm looking for when they're going to start the race. I start kind of peeking in behind.
What's the field size?
The field size in our race was 30, I think. So again, not a whole lot of transplant patients, especially competing at an international level. It's not like you're not going to have a field size of 100, you know? I mean,
yeah.
So I get up on the line and I'm thinking to myself, all right, I just want to try and go as hard as I can. I just want to try and go as hard as I can from the beginning. So whistle goes off. I clip into my pedals and I immediately like am out of the saddle going as hard as I can. And I see that the moto is not really paying that much attention. And so I'm like, I'm going to ride this moto until he gets out of the way. So I get on the moto.
They don't have a neutral section, right? It's like on.
Yeah, it's on. Okay. It's on.
All right.
So I get on the moto and boom, we're doing 30 miles an hour. And I get on the moto and we're approaching the first roundabout and I'm like, this could be it. I see that I have a good gap. And I know that if I have a good gap and I can just, if I can just lay into that gap for a little bit, that people are going to look up the road and they're going to say, we can't beat him. So we're not going to try. I mean, which of course isn't true. It's not accurate. But if people can collectively believe that, then it is true.
Yeah.
Right?
We've seen that happen over and over.
Yeah. So I'm coming into the first roundabout and the moto is kind of paralyzed because they can't take the roundabout at the same speed that I'm coming. And so I'm screaming at the moto, go, 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 go. And they're just, I don't know what they're doing. They're just stuck in the middle of the road. So I don't want to concede those 5 seconds or whatever that it would have been to try and wait for the moto. So I just shoot around the moto, go on the inside. go on the inside of the roundabout. And then I'm out of the saddle again. And then I'm looking back. And I see, I think, a guy from Italy. I can kind of see him coming out after me. But I know that if I can just lay on it for about 60 seconds, right? I mean, for people that don't race, you know, USA Cycling or kind of local type racing, if you're not used to 60 seconds all out, that's really jarring.
Do you think some of these other competitors, now you said someone was within 30 seconds of you on the TT. Oh, did these other guys race a lot, you think?
Or? I know some of them do. I don't know to what level they do. I can only assume that, I've been lucky. My life is cycling. So I have the good fortune of, you know, not just immersing myself in cycling, but being in a place in Sacramento to where you can't go on a group ride and not ride with really good people.
Yeah, we're really fortunate. Today we did this Coffee Republic ride, which is a great one.
Yeah.
You know, our competitor is the River Ride, which has a long storied history of, you know, 7-Eleven riders and many. We have a myriad of group rides in this area. We're very fortunate. So just
by showing up and doing a group ride here in a local area, you're probably going to get better. There's going to be a progression of getting better. I doubt it that other transplant cyclists have that same asset as we do, you know, as I do here in Sacramento. So at 60 seconds, I'm just on it. And then I can kind of look behind me and I can kind of see that it's broken a little bit and that people have come back. And then from that point, I'm thinking to myself, cause there was a lot of Spanish riders. There's maybe seven on the Spanish team. There was maybe four or five from the Dutch team. So in my mind, I'm thinking, I don't know what conversations they might be having. It seems sensible to me that they could say that in that amount of time, they could say, hey, let's just all take a turn at the front and let's rotate through. But one of the things that would make that difficult is that we're on the same course as the TT.
I was going to ask, you just do that four times? Is that?
Yeah.
Six or seven times.
Oh,
so you just did that like a circuit then?
Yeah, it was basically like a circuit. So you got a whole bunch of 180s, you got a whole bunch of roundabouts.
It's like
so,
a big crit.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a big crit, except it would be even more difficult to cohesively, rotate together and kind of try and bring somebody back. So I'm going around and I'm at the same time, all I want to hear. So my wife is standing on the side of the road and I had asked her before. So talking about details, I had one of my friends, because there's no like neutral support vehicle. And so he took off his wheels. One of my teammates from the US, he took off his wheels and we had that kind of at the beginning of the course. And I'm thinking, if I get a flat tire, hopefully I can at least just ride it out and I can grab those wheels. So in my mind, I'm thinking, I want to try and build up a big enough gap to where even if I get a flat tire, it's still going to buy me some time where I could get back into the group, you know?
So they did not have any kind of support?
They did there, but it's not like USA Cycling where you're going to get a free lap or where there's a follow vehicle that might give you a wheel. So, and for anyone that's really competitive, those details are really nerve-wracking. To the thought that you could prepare for a race like this and then you could get a flat tire and then be done, that made me feel really, really anxious. So it was like any detail that I could kind of handle before that. So
to be clear, you took your backpack off for the race.
I took my, yes, I did.
All the torque wrenches and your tubes.
Yeah, I took my backpack off. And my saddle bag. And so Christy's there.
But you left the fanny pack on.
Yeah,
right?
I left the fanny pack was fine. So Christy's there and she's just giving me time gap. And I'm just, all I want to hear right is that my time gap isn't going down. Like, as long as it's not going down. So going around lap after lap after lap, and I couldn't hear her that well, but I could, you know, in addition to what she was telling me, and then in addition to kind of, because of the course, you could kind of see, it's kind of like a pursuit in some ways. You know, you could kind of see how much you were gaining on the group. So that was another awesome day. Just to have the experience to be there, to be healthy. My bike worked. Nothing went wrong, and I was able to ride pretty much as hard as I could for, 30-something minutes.
So you did basically have a 20K TT.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how it turned out. But, you know, for me, my thought going into these races is how can you, you know, what are the different variables in the race? And if you can control every single one of those variables, one of them being safety, right? So for some of these riders, maybe they're not comfortable going into roundabouts. Well, I want to make sure that I don't get caught up with somebody in a roundabout or in one of the 180s. I'd gone down to the furthest 180 I looked at the first, and even from the other day, they had not swept the gravel out of the middle of the 180. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, that's another thing, right? You could be coming into that 180, and if you're in there with a group, all it takes is one person to kind of maybe, you know, hit a little piece of that gravel and kind of, you know, kind of slide out and hit you. So that was kind of my strategy was, is anything that I can control in the race to make sure that I do as well as possible, that's how, you know, that's how I'm going to race it.
So they had an award ceremony. I'm sure you got, I saw pictures.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. See you up there in your USA skin suit. Did you, by the way, did you wear that on the 4th of July ride at all? Obligated at this point.
I would. It's not that I wouldn't. It's not that I'm not above that.
I've never seen you wear it.
Well, the problem is that it has no pocket. So it's not like your Castelli San Remo.
Hanging back.
Yeah. There's not a context. There's not a context that you could wear that and have anything in your pocket. So,
you know, I was watching the tour and, you know, dozens of guys are wearing these San Remo skin suits. And back way back in the day when I rode, we didn't have pockets in those, and you would be shunned for wearing a skin suit in a road race like that. So that's a great innovation. You know, obviously having pockets in those allowed you to. So I'm disappointed you're not wearing that in the local rides.
Yeah, I am. If I could have a USA San Remo, that's my favorite kit to wear.
So how long did you stay over in Spain after? Did you and your wife take a little
time? Yeah, so we were there for a couple days before, and my wife was really concerned, I think rightly so, that I would be able to compartmentalize my competitiveness and wanting to prepare for the race with what she hoped would be some really interesting travel days beforehand. Because I told her straight up, I said, I don't know how to be over there and not be consumed with preparing for this race.
So did you just do it all after?
No, we didn't. We didn't. So we got there. We dropped my bike off. I opened it up. I looked at it just to make sure there wasn't anything visible.
Yeah.
It had been cracked. We were able to put it in our hotel that we were staying at. And then we went and stayed at another nearby town. And we stayed there for a couple days. And then it worked out really well. My wife understood that when we came back, it was basically going to be 3 days of, you know, putting my bike together, you know, ensuring that I've got all the tools I need.
And you were okay with not riding for a few days? You prepped your...
Yeah, I prepped. I knew that was not going to... That if I was going to be able to have this travel experience with my wife to where I could commit to just doing that and having fun. And this is an overall philosophy that I use with cycling anyways, is that like... I'm not going to take my bike and try and mix up the family vacation and the bike. It doesn't work that way. Like for me, I would rather load up my riding and then look at my training and saying, all right, I'm not going to ride for 4 days. That's not maybe ideal, but I'm not a pro. That works. That's, you know, we're going to have a great time as a family. And then that way I'm not constantly trying to, and there's other contexts where maybe you need to ride and that, you know, it works that way. But for this, it worked out really well. We met, we dropped off my bike. We did some incredible travel. It was the first time we traveled together in probably 8 years or so. So it was a really cool, in addition to that, so we had planned a really incredible trip, a 2-week backpacking trip to Patagonia about a year and a half ago. And this was going to kind of be our celebratory post-liver transplant trauma. You know, this was going to be the trip. This is a backpacking trip that I had been dreaming about since I was in high school. You know, I was in high school. Teacher was talking and I wasn't listening, and I would have my backpacking magazines out, and I'm just, you know, I've been thinking about this forever, and I ended up getting...
Did you hide those
sick.
Under your bed too? Yeah. My backpacking magazine. Yeah. Look at this fleece. Yeah.
So I ended up getting really, really sick, and we had to cancel that trip, and we weren't able to go. So this was kind of a really, really significant... It wasn't just a trip about travel and racing. It was a trip about us, right? Our kids were not with us. Our kids were with my wife's parents. And so it was a really unique time to be able to experience something together as a couple that we had, not just because of kids, but also because of 4 years being defined by transplant, by health and by complications. And so it was significant in a lot of different ways. It was significant from the racing perspective to being there with the transplant community to, you know, my wife and I having that opportunity to travel together. And we got sick at the end of it, and that was, you know, unforgettable, or that was very forgettable. But
how'd that make the flight? Was that, were you sick on the flight?
Well, no, it was weird. The final day, I was sick and in bed all day, and then we made the flight, and then I felt fine on the flight. And then the next day, my wife got really sick. So thankfully, we were able to avoid being really sick on the flight. It was kind of, you know, bookending that.
So what's your idea? Are you going to continue on with the next transplant games, and where is it at, and what's your whole motivation there?
Yeah, so the next transplant games is going to be in Newcastle, UK. And so I definitely plan to go, you know, and I think most transplant athletes have a similar, when I look at that, I say, if I'm healthy, I'm going to be there. But for me, 2 years is different than someone else's 2 years. Like for other people, they can look at 2 years, 2 years, and they can be like, yeah, I'm going to do that in 2 years. But for me, I haven't had 2 years without something significant happening.
Well,
for a long
you mentioned
time.
To me today, and you've told me this story many times, you go in for blood work.
Yeah.
And then explain to me the stress and anxiety that entails.
Yeah. So as a transplant patient, as a liver transplant patient, you know, you're always getting blood work done to assess your liver function, and not just your liver function, but also other blood work markers that essentially tell a story about the health of your transplant. So for me, I've never been able to go probably more than 6 or 7 months of, I would say, encouraging and positive blood work. I've had enough complications to where what that process is like is, you know, going to the lab, getting your blood work done on a monthly basis. Usually the blood work comes back pretty quickly. It usually comes back within that same day. Email comes into my email box, and you know, the moment that I see that, I see what the address is from, and I'm wherever I'm at. If I'm on the bike, if I'm in the car, not if I'm driving, but you know, I'm opening up that email, I'm clicking on those test results, and I'm quickly scanning down to these metrics that basically define everything about what my life could be in the next couple weeks. And that can range from awesome. That's a big relief. I don't have to have blood work done for a month. Like, you know, it's kind of like a free bill of health. It can range from that kind of relief to I don't know what's going on. The doctor's going to call me. And then I have no idea what my life is going to look like. Is my life going to be, you know, hospitalization? Is it going to be another significant procedure? That, you know, that reality is what makes looking ahead into the distance a totally different prospect. So I plan to be there at the transplant games in 2 years, but it's hard for me to even conceptualize what that looks like. I mean, 2 years, that's, you know, that's 24 different blood tests. You know, I've never had 24 positive blood tests in a row. It's never worked that way. I've been lucky enough to where the transplant games have happened during times when I've had good health. But then I've also been, you know, I've also had other trips and stuff derailed. So I hope to be there. It's an awesome experience. My wife will definitely come back.
Just to, in case anyone from USA Cycling listen, when he says positive blood test, it's not the same thing. Okay.
Well, it's not. Totally different.
Test.
Favorable.
Yeah. Favorable.
I got to interject something because you're talking about the complication with the liver test. You're driving up to the Chico stage race and got the news that he had to cancel that trip.
Right.
And I'm sitting there and like, I've had awesome memories racing with Nate, and he's telling me, you know,
this is the Patagonia trip.
Yep. His Patagonia trip. And he's processing the news that, you know, he's been looking forward to this trip for years, you know, for a decade, and he's coming up to race. We got the circuit race starting in like 2 hours. He gets the news. Boom, we can't go to Patagonia. The world gets flipped upside down. And I'm sitting there like, you know, thinking about what he's trying to process. I'm trying to get ready for the race. We're trying to convince him to stay because he's like, I just want to go home and be with my wife. And like, you know, trying to get him to, you know, it's hard to figure out what all is going through his mind. I mean, only he's going to know that. But long story short, he stuck it out. He raced really well.
I lost really well.
Well, hey. I mean, all things considered.
Yeah.
You know, you put it in perspective.
Yeah.
You know, dealing what you're dealing with. But we were going into the Pescanta stage race, day two of the race. And finished the first lap, and this kid's in front of us. And I just, like, start making, I'm just like, hey, how's it going, man? He's like, not so good. Got to suppressed immune system. I was like, oh yeah? And he's just like, yeah, I got a cold like a week ago. Nate's right.
That's right, probably his ride title on Strava,
yeah,
too,
it's
right?
Yeah, and
lowering expectations.
And we kind of just like, I was like, oh, that's, you know, that sucks. And I just kind of look at Nate and have like this smile. And you get these moments of perspective where it's like, you know, we have our outcomes in a race and we have these, you know, successes and failures, a lot more failures than successes on the bike, you know, when you compete. But, you know, there's always the perspective of like, oh, it can always be a lot worse than just not winning a bike race.
You have your health and you don't have to have a monthly blood test. And yeah.
And that was, I think one of the coolest memories was, well, we finished the road race right next to each other. And you know, here I'm doing a road race.
The asthmatic kid or Nate?
No, Nate and I.
Oh. I think he got dropped.
Yeah, he got dropped.
Well, you suppress that immune system, you know, get all that dust and Piscinta.
Yeah, that's true. That ground
pushed too hard.
But we, you know, we finished the race and pretty decent, pretty good results, all things considered. But, you know, we get through that and we get up to Cascade. And I think Cascade, was that? That was 2 years ago. So that was right after Argentina. Because I almost crashed you out at the Dunnigan Flats race at the front of the line when that guy almost took my wheel out.
Yeah, that was right before Argentina. Yeah.
So
that was actually the last race.
Dunnigan was. And then you went to Argentina and then we went up to Cascade when you got back, just like we're about to do. Finished the circuit race day 4 and we're sitting in the car and Nate's like, hey, today it's the 2 year anniversary. I think it was it the 2 year anniversary?
Yeah, so it's July.
Because they moved Cascade a week later. Because when you had it done, it was during the Twilight race in
Santa
Fe. Okay.
So we finished. We're back in the car, like loading up. And I had, you know, our team had some success there. It had been a great race, and you know, he went through adversity in the race. Like, you know, didn't have his small ring for any of that circuit race, and he was there, boom. And he kept saying that he'd come back up there, and he was there to support me. I'm right here, man.
Maybe with some colorful language.
Yeah, there was some language in there. But he, I mean, he finished the race. He, you know, all things considered, a lot of people would just, you know, he wouldn't want to do it, and definitely would just pull the plug or couldn't do it. And so we get back to the car, and he's like, hey, he just said it quietly. He's like, today is the 2 year mark. You know, it's like, oh shit. You know, I mean, you put that in perspective and it's like, man.
Do you use that? Do you use that as motivation at all? Like you hear the kid, oh, my nose is a little stuffy.
Yeah. So
and you're like, this isn't my original liver.
Yeah. I don't use it as motivation, but I do. I think that people are so limited by those cop outs, you know, like that. That's what when I hear that, I just think to myself, you know, I wouldn't say that it motivates me, but I just think you could be so much better if that wasn't what was defining your race experience right now, you know, or defining what your level of progress is in the sport. And I, you know, I hope that I'm able to share that with, you know, the clients that I coach, but nobody wants to hear, you know, unsolicited advice like that. But when I do hear that, I just think, you know, I guess it's measured though, because as I can look at a comment like that and say, you know, well, that's cute. There's, you know, 1,000 other people that could look at me and could say, bro, you don't know what adversity is. Like you had a liver transplant, you had the best medical care, you know, maybe in the world at a UCSF hospital. Like that's not adversity. You know what adversity is? Adversity is having no health insurance. Adversity is, you know, having sickness and not having any family support, not having any friends that care about you. Right. So
keistering a weapon in prison.
There it is.
So, you know, there's always this level of, you know, you can always look at someone else and say, I feel like you can always look at someone else and say they are handling a greater amount of adversity better than I am. And I'd say that's what motivates me, is that there's never any, you know, even though I know kind of what's coming in terms of, you know, I have regular blood tests and my own mortality or my own health is on constant reminder. In reality, that's not any different than anyone else. It's just that they don't know about it, right? They're not constantly reminded by it. And I think you could maybe even make the case that there's a performance advantage to that in some ways, right? Is that you're going to live your life differently. You're going to train differently. You're going to get a different experience out of a race When you know that, when you have that perspective, and that's an advantage. You could only define that as an advantage to someone else who is like, oh, I have, you know, I had a cold last night. This really sucks to be here today. It's like, well, I mean, they're going to get less out of that race experience, and they're not going to be as good.
So we can transition out of some of this and go into kind of what you're doing as a coach. Do you go over, besides just the physical aspects, do you dig into your clients and kind of do this motivational, because you really have a good perspective, right? A lot of it is, it's the positive way of looking at things. It goes back to my friend that only saw the negative side of racing, and you can't continue when you're done with a race and all you can think about is the pain, you know, and rather than, hey, I finished and I feel good. I mean, do you work on that with your clients?
Yeah. And it's really interesting too, to talk with, you know, so the other coach, one of the other coaches that works with us, Matt Chatleon, I enjoy talking with other coaches too about proposing this maybe sticking point that an athlete's having and saying, what was the advice that you gave them? Because I think in a lot of ways, coaches in general, and this isn't just for cycling coaches, but for any coach, they are, I would say in some ways, they're genetically gifted to be doers, right? And they come across adversity and they can just work through it. And that's a gift. It's a gift just like a 1700 watt sprint is a gift, right? And so I think oftentimes that's an impediment to connecting with clients, because you look at someone and you say, why don't you just do it? Why don't you just work harder? What's your problem, right? And it takes work to say, not everyone has the same tools to be able to frame challenges in the same way that I do, or maybe that other coaches are. You know, other coaches, generally coaches weren't the best. The best coaches were very rarely, if ever, the best in their sport, right? Yeah. I think what made them, what makes them the best coach, or what makes them a great coach, is that they can communicate, they can teach concepts. You know, they have good interpersonal skills to where they can support a client and talk through that stuff. So I think that's the side of coaching that I think is probably even more exciting to be a part of than writing what I would hope would be great workouts. It's talking to someone and saying, talk me through the final five laps of that race. I want to know what you were thinking of, because I know on paper you have the power. You have the power output to win that race. Tell me what was holding you back? Like, what fears were holding you back? Why didn't you make that decision? Those are types of discussions. And oftentimes those go big. They go from, you know, I've never believed in myself, or, you know, my dad never thought much of me as an athlete. I mean, you know, and obviously there's a line to where
you're what kind of counsel you'll give.
Yeah. Well, no, there's a line to where I think a cycling coach has, you know, would need to say, this is outside my area of expertise. And, you know, maybe if it's really big, you need to talk to somebody else. But in the context of sport and of getting better, those are the best conversations as a coach.
So thinking of basketball, there's two prime examples that I always look back on is Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan, who were amazing players and didn't excel at all as coaches. They tried, failed. Yeah. But with what you're just saying, it does help. You may not be the best athlete and best cyclist ever, but yet being one, it's got to help as far as being a coach. Because you're not just coaching the person that wants to go out and do the death ride and finish and do some grand fondo. You're doing racers too, and it does make a difference. I would imagine. I don't want to get a workout coach from someone that's very large and unfit. So.
Yeah. No, I think what matters is maybe less. In my mind, at least, I think what matters is less the level of success that someone has achieved, whether or not that's on like a world tour level or whatever. But it's a work ethic that they've displayed in their sport, right? Like to me, at least for me, if I'm looking at a coach, you know, there's someone who's achieved a ton of success, and I think that's attractive. And it might be that person also has great coaching skills too. But you know, how did they get there in the sport? You know, what have they done? What have they? I guess those stories are more interesting to me than just a level of success. But I think definitely, you know, achieving success, no one would discount that. That's a valuable perspective. That you can't know what it's like. It's very difficult to coach someone through winning a bike race if you have not been in any of those scenarios, any of those competitive scenarios. I don't think it's impossible, but it's certainly, you know, I think an asset to being able to, you know, talk through and having known those different fears and, you know, known those different mentally what it takes to race and you know, all those pieces.
Do you have any athletes coming up that are going to be, we should know about, that are going to be hitting the big time? Anything you want to disclose?
Yeah.
No.
Travis Retzer is the future of American cycling, and I'm going to say that right now.
So we're going the way of like India.
That's if that's future, then
no, I think
that's a shame.
I think you know, that's the really rewarding thing about cycling coaching is that, you know, let's say you're coaching somebody who is winning a world championship or whatever. I've never done that, but you can imagine that would be rewarding and exciting on, you know, on a really unique level. But then you have someone else who has worked for a couple years to achieve a level of success on the bike that they never dreamed possible. And that is incredible in a different way. So I think that's one of the really cool things about cycling coaching is that everybody comes to the sport with different limitations on their time, with different level of support from their family, with different athletic backgrounds. And, you know, success in the sport is progressing, whether or not that's at a world tour level or whether or not that's at a Cat 5 level, and whether or not that's, you know, winning your first bike race and having a chance to experience what that's like. And, you know, hopefully one day I get to I get to experience what it's like to be a part of someone's success at a, you know, at a world tour level. But that's one experience. It's not a better experience.
You know, and Travis isn't really pulling out of the bag right now. So.
I hate saying this right now in a public forum, but Travis will not be going to the world tour.
I'm leaving on that note.
Okay. So Nate, appreciate it. Best of luck. Thanks for the inspiring story your double. How do we even describe this? Because you won two races at two different world championships.
Well, how
do you put that into like a tweet? How do you do it in 140 characters?
You wouldn't. This is what I've realized is that the people that are, you know, like, I think that really good cyclists are really they don't need just. You don't need to say it in any special way.
I think Nate's doing his part on making America great again.
Well, that skin suit, it was nice and tight. It looked good.
Very tight.
Was doing everything. Well, okay, Nate Dunn, appreciate it. Thank you so much. Travis, thank you. Good luck to both of you in Cascade. Chris Fowler. Flower, sorry.
That's the that L was not.
I'm having a trouble. You're going to Cascade as well, right?
Yes, I am. That's pure excitement.
We got that on
the
audio right now.
Gentlemen,
I didn't say when.
Thank you very much. We'll do it again.
Yes, thank you. It's not the end.